Good morning to you, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. It's the 21st now, isn't it? Something like that. Monday, bank holiday Monday. I have an interview at 4 o'clock. I've just looked at my diary. I wonder what people are up to today. Yesterday I was just putting the light on there. Just working on the book. I worked really hard, actually. I can't even remember if I went out for a stroll. I think I did go for a stroll. Haven't really seen very many people. The lovely Julia was away. So I've been pretty much a hermit, really, working on the book. I hope it all pays off. I hope it's all worth it. And I hope people manage to... Well, I mean, I hope some people buy it somewhere along the line. And I hope it makes sense. And I'm on the end now. I really am at the end. And this is what I... You see, what I did when I was writing, I wrote close to the end on the first draft. I wasn't quite sure how to finish it. And then I thought, well, I need to go back over what I've written just to remind myself, really, of some of the events and characters. Although there was a plot, I had written a sort of basic one-line plot. So-and-so does this, then this happens, then that, then the other. And, of course, Julia very kindly kept a little Bible, if you like, of each of the characters, who they are, what they are, and how they develop and what have you. Because I was sending her the manuscript as I was writing it. So she would write down, you know, who the characters were, etc. And, but even so, on this one, because it's an ensemble piece, in other words, there's many characters that make up the, that are the central characters. Instead of a plot that's driven by, it might have loads of characters, but it's not a plot that's driven by one protagonist. There's many of them. It's and so, you know, you kind of go, have I covered all that? And what did he do? And how did that end up? And I hadn't plotted it in advance. It's all slowly. And I never plot in advance. I like the serendipity or the creativity or even the being guided, I suppose, by the characters themselves as to the direction of the plot. And as it unfolds to me, I get a hint of where it's going. But this one, I did know the end. You know, sometimes you don't know the end at all. And sometimes you've got, okay, this is the setup and it's got to get to here. I don't know how it's going to get there, but it's just got to get there. And I think this is it. But within that, your journey, so it's a bit like a journey. I've got to go from Sussex, from the coast to London, let's say. And that's the thing. You've got to go from here to there. But in ongoing from the coast to London, it may be you end up in Edinburgh or Australia en route, but you've got to end up in London. And I don't know whether I'm going to Edinburgh or Sydney in Australia when I start writing, if you see what I mean. And then if you find yourself, oh, I'm actually in Sydney, Australia, towards the end of the book, for whatever reason that the story has taken you, somehow you've got to get to London, you know, and that last bit might be, and they took a flight to London, and that's it, you know, quite simple. And it may be that that's a satisfactory thing, that you didn't want to wade through loads of other explanation. Or it may be that you're in Sydney, Australia, or wherever it is, and to just get on the flight and go, oh, and they flew to London, is unsatisfactory, that the audience would go, oh, that was a bit easy. Because, you know, you could end a book in one sentence, can't you? You could just simply say, and they lived happily ever after, and an atom bomb landed and they all died. You know, you can end the story quite easily, but you want to have it a satisfactory ending that people, you know, build up to. Now, in an adventure story, of course, there is usually a setup, the meat and two veg, as it were, and then the big finale. But not all books have a big finale. There were a number of large incidents in the R.F. Delderfield novels that we've read. And sometimes they just sort of, that's life. You know, you get that sort of sense, we've had a pocket of life. You've looked through the keyhole and you've seen events. Some of them have sorted themselves out, some of them haven't. And you've just withdrawn at the end. And that's still satisfactory because you know, it would seem bizarre to have, and it would seem, what would be the word, too theatrical, false, to have a big ending for that kind of book. And I think mine is kind of in the latter of that. It's, we've looked through the keyhole at these people running around. They've realised that there's problems. They've worked out they need to do something. They've worked out how they're going to do that. And then they start doing it. And the people who don't want them to do it, or rather, find that they, in the end, there's no choice. And really, it's so, and that's it. Because, I mean, you know, Biggleswick, the town that doesn't comply. What I don't want to imply, is that, in my estimation, if a town were to do what I suggest, it wouldn't be full of horror stories. And that's the so I want to have it positive. What I don't want to depict is that to be free from tyranny, in reality, is such a huge fight that a lot of people get injured. I mean, that may be true in depending on which type of fight, but a lot of this is dealing with what's legal and what's lawful and what's actually true, as far as I can see. I think people will probably, if they read it, some people will enjoy it, but I think there'll be those out there that will slate it because they won't be quite able to accept some of the things that I suggest. Anyway, there's enough about my book. I've left it a bit, mystical, not mystical. What's the word I'm looking for? First thing in the morning, cup of coffee. See, I do this all the time. I know that the word is there. We've left it sort of mysterious. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. And then continually you go, oh, I'll think of the word. And then later on when you read through the, you go, oh, what I meant to say was da 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 da. Cryptical. That's not the word, is it? What's the word? When you leave a few clues, but it's cryptical? That's not it. Why am I keep coming back to that word? Anyway, not critical. Do you do that? Do you find that sometimes you just struggle with, there's this little hurdle. It's only a tiny little hurdle. And you keep tripping on it. And you go, I keep tripping on this bloody little hurdle. I can step over it in trying to find, you know, a word that you know so well. Anyway, the old brain. Or is it the mind? Is it the tuning fork not working properly? I've got a cup of coffee. I'm sitting here I didn't tell you it was 7:15, did I? It was 7:15 when I started, anyway. And so I didn't really do very much else. I did a lot of reading as well. I broke off and I did some reading. Oh, the H.E. Bates. I read that. It was only a very short thing, The Simple Life, and it was interesting. He does write very well, does old H.E. Bates, and he does write about, he writes very well, I think, about emotional things, and of course, and it's of its time as well, and he was writing of his time. which was fascinating. I always think that time, I don't know quite when you would have pitched that, probably in the 50s, 60s, maybe. A bit stylized, but it was good. I mean, I won't bore you with the story of it, but it was only very short. But it was a kind of you see, I can't do it today. That thing where you do something and then you get payback for it. Karma. Thank you. Karma. God, dear. it was a bit like karma in there. That, you know, she does something which she shouldn't do, and then it comes back on her, the woman that was bored of that that barren place. And as I read it, it did sound like it was down near Dungeness, somewhere like there, because he mentions a marsh. Although there's a sort of a pebbly plain, isn't there, down on Dungeness, at that down there. But it's down by the coast or near the coast. And in the distance, there's a power station. So I thought, I wonder if it's that one. But I dare say there are other power stations that are in the middle of nowhere by a marsh and by the on the coast. But that was the only one I'm familiar with that might have been around down there. I think it was EDF that runs it, or it may have been sold anyway. Whatever, doesn't matter, does it? So today we could go and have a look at Kilvert's diary. We've done a lot of that, haven't we? I thought again it might be the time to do a random book from the shelf, and so I am picking up this book by Barry Trinder. And it's called Beyond the Bridges, The Suburbs of Shrewsbury, 1760 to 1960. When I used to go up and see Harriet, as you will remember, if you have been a very long-term listener of this, my previous girlfriend, who's married now, by the way, to a dentist. We broke up some 7-odd years ago now, it must be. Anyway, and Lola, the little dachshund that she had, the long-haired dachshund, I think it's called a red, although it's actually brown. I don't know why they call them reds when they're actually brown. So she's not a black and tan as her Tilly. I wonder if Tilly's still going strong. That was her auntie, but I don't think, it might have been her real auntie, because I think Harriet got the dog from a breeder. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Any, all of that's water under the bridge. Yes, so what I was going to say is when I used to go and see Harriet, I used to go up to there all the time. I've just found in this book a card from Harriet. She is in Portugal. Where was this? This is sent by Moonpig. Hence, it's anyway. So this is just again. I thought I'd read a paragraph or so, just for a bit of fun, from a random book off my shelf. And this, I guess, this is not going to be of any interest to anybody too much. However. I do like these sort of books. When you're a writer, and I daren't really call myself a writer until I have actually got books published or whatever. But when you write stories, novels or whatever, it's good to immerse yourself in books of places, because often you need to describe places. And if you're... I'm going back to... Well, I'm with Biggleswick. It's an interesting town. And is it a bit like Shrewsbury? I don't know. I hadn't really thought of it as like Shrewsbury. It's very much its own place. And Shrewsbury is a fascinating thing because it's within the horseshoe shape of the River Severn. And you can see why with the horseshoe shape of the River Severn, it acts as a natural defence, or would have done. And of course, there were skirmishes between the English and the Welsh. And so hence there was a castle there, I think built by Roger Montgomery, if I remember rightly, a red sandstone castle, which is still there. And all around that area, in fact, there are lots of motts and baileys. It's a fascinating area to go. And I'd like to go back to Shropshire and explore. It is a lovely county, and it's a county that I feel at home in, because I kept going up there for about 10 years. I do feel at home there. And I watch a chap, Father John, who's in Shropshire. He's in South Shropshire, near a place called Craven Arms on the Long Mynd, and near Clun. I've made several videos of all that round the area on the Long Mynd and Clun and various places, and I know it reasonably well. Bishop's Castle, thanks to going up to seeing Harriet, and in a way I love Sussex, but it's got so busy. It's become a metropolis now, in parts. East Sussex is beautiful and more isolated, and I like that, but very rich. Shropshire is rich in terms of the land, but I think it's poorer in terms of industry. And I quite like that. I don't mean that to be disparaging to anybody living there, but I quite like the fact that it's old. It's old rural England. But people move out because there's no jobs. So anyway, beyond the bridges, the suburbs of Shrewsbury. Shrewsbury stands on a sandstone eminence, encircled by a horseshoe bend in the River Severn. A castle guards its landward approach. Spires and towers punctuate the skyline. It is an archetypal city on a hill. Yet Shrewsbury had suburbs recorded in Doomsday Book, and since 1760 most of the growth has been beyond its bridges. Historians have given relatively little attention to the suburbs, the homes of large numbers, perhaps the majority of the English people. The process that has shaped patterns of houses, the chronology of growth, and changing social... Sorry, I was thinking cryptic. That was what I was trying to get to. It was cryptic. I've left it. It's a bit cryptic, what I was saying. You know, that word I was stumbling on earlier, it just suddenly came back to me as I was reading, and then I was thinking in it and trying to read at the same time, which is very difficult. Excuse me. Yes, the process that has shaped the pattern of houses, the chronology of growth and changing social structures, are understood in very few towns. This book takes a case study, one of the primary towns of England, by examining its growth over two centuries, and attempts to pose and answer questions in ways that will illuminate the history of all English towns. The word suburb is sometimes taken to mean a self-sustaining part of a large city with an identity of its own, as in a study of the early 1980s that analysed Acton, Ealing, Bromley and Headingley. Yes, I suppose that's true, you know. You end up with satellite, like in Worthing, I suppose, where we are, you would have Storrington. I mean, these are all individual little villages that you would traipse on a horse and cart or what have you, or walk a mile or so. Tarring, you know, is its own thing. Worthing wasn't even a thing. You had Broadwater, Tarring, Heen. You know, you had all of these. You had Shoreham. And as that area grew, Worthing was no more than just a bunch of fishermen's cottages, and developed relatively late, thanks to the old business of taking the water, and people realising that actually going into salt water or drinking salt water was healthy, and it became... its own very, very pale imitation of a Brighton or Bognor Regis. But it grew then rapidly, and Worthing then sort of amalgamated to the point that Worthing, the name, and the town took over. And these satellite villages, which were villages in their own right, so these villages in their own right became satellite villages swallowed up in the conurbation. I mean, it's fascinating. All of this, I think, is absolutely fascinating. At the same time, it is dreadful. It's dreadful that these little individual places have been swallowed up, that the conurbation, that the urban sprawl just goes on and is never-ending, as we've... And how that happens, the infill of boring, mean houses, especially now with the new builds that they put up everywhere, and they have been doing for some time, you know, has really added to the uglification of this country. The Victorians sort of started it, didn't they, with their long streets of identical red brick houses, completely new, when the bricks were around, you know, since Queen Anne days, but bricks had to be made and transported, if they were to be transported, by horse and cart, which wasn't easy. So you couldn't get that many bricks, you know, it would take forever to get them to where they've got to be, unless you went by river or canal. And so brick didn't really come around, you know, you'd have these big country piles, Queen Anne style houses, and they would have these large lakes if it was suitable. And the bricks, the clay, if it was a clay soil in that area or subsoil, then what would happen? You know, I have a house here, please. Right, okay. What we'll do is we'll dig a dirty, great big hole right in front of where you want it, or behind where you want it, where the soil is best. And the clay that's dug out will be the bricks, and we make handmade bricks. They build the house. Then you've got this dirty, great hole. Well, they filled it with water, and it became a beautiful lake. And what's such a simplistic and basic idea, you know, for these large country piles, of course, because they've got all the land. And so why wouldn't you use the clay and stuff? You don't need to transport it then. Only for, you know, may only be 100 yards or whatever it is. Or even half a mile, depending on where you know, it's not got to go very far. But the Victorians with their red brick houses, we had to wait. Not we had to. It wasn't until, let me rephrase that, until the railways came in. And when the railways came in the 1835 upwards, really, but the mainstay, I would say, was the 1850s, once you've got that type of freight, railways came in and you could transport huge amounts of brick, of bricks, and the brickworks would be positioned near a railway station, and the expansion of these towns once a railway station arrived meant that the Victorians would spew out these things. And I sit in one of those houses, and at first it would have been a shock, an absolute shock to the beautiful landscape. And I remember talking about this, I think, either in the Vogue show audio thing that I used to do, or a Bald Explorer video some years ago. And I remember saying how appalled I was at all the new builds and what have you. And a chap called Steve, was it? I know, yes. Anyway, I won't embarrass him by his name. But he said, and I remember the comment, he said, that's you're being hypocritical, because you live in one of these. The Victorians did just the same, and you're in one, and you've been in it for, you know, 30, 40 years, whatever it is. And and it was right, in as much as that is, I still live in the same house, and it is a Victorian terrace, and it is part of the expansion of Worthing. And this was not as early as that, but it was in 1875. When my house was constructed, And it was the beginning of the whole road and this whole area, which expanded between 1875 and, well, 1900, I suppose. Over 100 years ago. And that's very true. And at first, but what a shock, just as you see these new builds now, what an absolute shock. The difference is that this is 150 years old, my house, 150 years old and still standing with relatively small amount of maintenance because it was well made. These new, and admittedly, tiny garden, if you can call it a garden. And these new builds, I suppose, I mean, one of the things I always argue about with the new builds is they have mean gardens, mean windows, and but not as substantially built. And I suppose it is hypocritical to say that. I suppose it is. And perhaps I just reflect what the Victorians in those times were thinking as they saw, as H.G. Wells saw back in the 1880s in Woking. Sorry about the delay there, thinking. In Woking, when he lived there, he saw the expansion and he saw the building everywhere and he saw thalodomites. Is that how you pronounce it? Thalodomites. The surveying tripods everywhere. And from that... Don't knock my microphone over, cat. From that, those tripods, the thalodomites, whatever they, however you say it, he saw them everywhere as the building work was going on, and he imagined, what if they were huge, towering over a house everywhere from another planet, and hence War of the Worlds began, and he talks of the tripods. And yes, the Victorians must have been just as shocked, and I suppose it is, and yet age has made many of the Victorians' houses acceptable more, and they become more beautiful. And there was a certain elegance, not the same as the Georgians. The Georgians had far better elegance. And the Tudor houses, well, certainly the rich people's ones that had these rather beautiful timber frame ones, wasn't so much designed by architectures, but more by... Well, they were designed, obviously, but not in the same way as you would. But they're just beautiful because they're organic. I'm trying to pin down why I hate the new build so much. They're ugly. They're ugly and they are pretentious. And I think that's what it is. They're ugly, pretentious, and they're put up incredibly quickly, and they're flimsy. Whereas I think the Victorian stuff is very much identical. But I think the Victorians were prouder, and they lined the streets with trees. They built parks, and they tried to beautify the area they lived in. I don't think... These modern houses, which are all stuffed into a field, apropos of nothing, are on the same... I think they try to. I think, you could... On the surface, you could say, well, they are of their time, and it's a similar sort of expansion to what the Victorians were doing with their houses. And I think on the surface, you could argue that. I agree. However, I don't think... I mean, the Victorians had the advantage that their expansion was close to town, and the houses were serving the people who worked in town or worked on the railroads, or, in my case, potentially fishermen, and a little local industry. Market gardening was a lot here with the greenhouses. So a lot of people will be working on that. Not so much the farming, although some farming would have been done. So that was really the main thing. And the railways provided the means to get that from here. There was loads of it, loads of it, because of the sunshine, you see, because of the beautiful sunshine. They weren't chemtrailing back then. Fortunately, back in the 1830s, they weren't chemtrailing. Now you'd be lucky to grow a peanut. So yeah, but I think there's something. Even though they would have been shocked, and probably initially, I don't know whether they were just so used to the countryside. Maybe now we value the countryside. I mean, that's the other thing. At the beginning of the motor car, say in the early 1910, 1920s, when the countryside was no longer just ubiquitous. People were in the countryside. A lot of the people were in the countryside until the railways came. People were in the countryside. And because of that, it was taken for granted. And it was boring. It was just, you know, it was boring. And I suppose cities and towns became a bit more interesting. You could earn a living there. You could have clean feet. You have boot scrapers, you know, and then tarmac and what have you. You could keep yourself clean. And there was a certain amount of confidence, albeit the air, with all the coal going up. You still had to go into the countryside to get clean air. But do you know what I mean? Do you understand? Do you get... Oh, I don't know quite where I'm going with all of this. Anyway, I could waffle on about this for ages. And it all comes from the opening of this book about the suburbs of... And again, I've picked that up and I've not got very far. It's, I love books and they take you on huge journeys. I've spoken for half an hour. I must stop. Thank you for listening. If you did, I hope you found that interesting. Or nobody listens anyway to this burbling idiot. But there you go. Take care. Have a good day. Bye for now.